This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
We went from normal life, healthy child to acute lymphoblastic leukemia or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
You deserve a moment to yourself every single day. And a delicious bite of a Keebler Sandies can give you that comforting pause. Celebrate the end of your workday with the melt-in-your-mouth magic of a Keebler Sandies. This magic is baked into simple shortbread cookies by Ernie and the Keebler Elves. So as another busy Tuesday flies by, make the most of your me moment. Take a pause and enjoy a Keebler Sandies.
Oh, hi. Hello, nerds. This is Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and I am your host, Liv. Today, I'm here with a conversation episode, and gods, are we returning to our roots. Today, I am joined by Dr. Maciej Paprocki to talk about, simply, mythology, Greek mythology, but of course, there is nothing simple about Greek mythology, and especially not when one is trying to assign some kind of order to the gods, to actually understand what rules and reasoning might have existed surrounding them. Maciej talks about trying to sort through some of the chaos that is the Greek gods, figuring out what kind of lineage equals what kind of divinity, who is a god because of their parents, when does that line kind of drift apart. We talk about everyone, what limitations exist around divinity. Oh my god, it's amazing. It's just about trying to understand the gods on like a fundamental and even orderly level. Honestly, it was just unbelievably interesting. I took so many notes even listening back to the episode to edit it today. And like, I learned so much, and now trying to explain it into like a sentence or two for you all is impossible because there's so much going on. Utterly fascinating. Now we did record this a while back now. I recorded a bunch of episodes at once, so you will hear me referencing writing a recent episode about Dionysus that is definitely not recent now. I think it was in like August or September. But just in case you got like excited about a new one, I'm sorry, there isn't one yet, at least. There's always more to say about Dionysus eventually. But this conversation was also just like so unbelievably insightful and interesting that we ended up speaking for over 2 hours because I couldn't stop. And I also didn't want to cut it down to a shorter episode. So instead, this is going to be two episodes. Part one will air this week and the second next week. I really learned so much about just the gods during this conversation, which I like to think at this point really says something, given I spend all day, every day reading the ancient sources and learning about the gods. But this topic and realm of research is just coming at them in such a different way. I cannot wait for you all to listen, so no more of my rambling. Conversations, assigning order to the chaos, theologizing the gods with Dr. Maciej Praprotsky.
So, if possible, I would like to start by reading a quote from Lev Grossman's book, The Magician King, which I think captures really nicely what my approach towards mythology is, if I may.
Yes.
So let me just bring this up. Imagine yourself to be a theologist, but a special kind of theologist, one who studies gods the way an entomologist studies insects. Take as your dataset the entirety of world mythology and treat it as a collection of field observations and statistics pertaining to a hypothetical species, the god. Proceed from there.
So I love that.
My approach is basically running circles around that, because I think that, you know, when I first started learning classical mythology and later on when I actually did my classics degree, I started asking my mythology teachers all sorts of awkward questions, like, why do the gods behave like that? And, you know, I had one of these teachers who told me, because the gods are stupid and you shut up. So basically, you know, okay. They weren't very pleased with me. But afterwards, you know, I found one teacher, you know, one professor of classics who was very, very kind to me. And she told me, basically, I don't know. This is how the Greeks wrote them. But I do suspect that there is logic to that. And I think you might want to try and find it out.
Mm.
And this is something that stayed with me year after year as I tried to look at these fascinating characters and try to see what this hypothetical species, a Greek god, whether it makes sense or not, and how it functions in the narrative world. And it has taken me many wonderful and strange places, and I'm still looking forward to the journey to be made in the Greek mythology world.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And it's one of those things like, I mean, it's so unanswerable, and yet searching for the answer is so interesting and so valuable. And like that, to me, that just adds so much more to it. Like, I have listeners who ask me kind of similar questions often, like, you know, but it's more so in the contradictions that exist in myth, because they are endless. You know, like, why does somebody behave this way in one myth and they behave this way in another? And I think the best part is how unanswerable it is and how you can kind of look at why one source would have one thing and why another would have another. And like, that's what's so interesting versus like actually trying to pin down a real, quote unquote, real personality for somebody, you know?
Yes, it wouldn't be as fascinating otherwise.
Yeah.
I think. And contradictions make a lot of sense. Basically, I do think that, well, there is unity and some sort of consistency to divine behavior. I like to work with narratological approaches, and I do love Sarah Alice Johnston's books on myth. Basically, she works with a story world approach. So she says that this is like a media franchise, like Harry Potter or Star Wars or whatever. And in every franchise, in every story world, there are rules for the characters to behave along. And basically, she says that this is the same in Greek mythology. And there are rules that the gods and the heroes and all the people who are inside the story world have to obey.
Mm.
More or less, because, you know, every author can change the rules or can bend them. But they usually have to have a really good reason to do so. And if they go too far with bending the rules of the story world, then the audiences will start suspending their disbelief. And, you know, they start thinking something's iffy here. Like, you know, things don't go together. Like, this isn't what we signed up for. And I think this is quite visible in many of the more risque or unusual treatments of the mythology. Like, you can see from the audiences asking, what is going on here? Like, we didn't sign up for this. But basically, I think if you look at the basics, for instance, Homer, Hesiod, and so on, this very early corpus, it pretty much sets some ground rules for the divine behavior, and they tend to follow it. Like, you know, there are some exceptions, there are different things and ways of doing things, but basically, I can say that the gods behave pretty much in a consistent way in these works. And in my own research, I try to focus on these, the oldest works, and see how the gods behave in these oldest poems. And then I try to extrapolate from that and try to explain all the weird inconsistencies. Sometimes I do this by just saying that this is something that is authorial invention. Like sometimes authors like to change things up, especially with the gods. For instance, Pindar doesn't like the gods behaving badly, so he tries to explain it away in many different ways. But I do love authors who like to show all the nitty-gritty details and all the terrible, embarrassing details from divine life, because I think these are more fascinating.
Absolutely. I mean, that's exactly why I have this show. It's like all the wild things they do, but also like, yeah, the examination of kind of why one source, you know, has one thing and one has another. I was just writing an episode on Dionysus, and he's so fascinating for that because, like, he's everywhere and he's nowhere, and, like, we have all these sources, but also, like, we don't have a ton of detailed sources on him that are, like, actually that old, but we always know that he was there. Like, it's so interesting to look at him, and again, it's just, like, fresh in my mind, but he's such an interesting example of that.
Yes, and you might try to make sense from it from a historical religious perspective, like trying to say that he's the god from a different place or he was worshipped differently. But then you can try to make sense from it from the inter-story world, you know, diegetic perspective, and try to see how does it work within mythology. I mean, are there any explanations within the material for why this happens? So, and sometimes there aren't any, but it's fun to hypothesize all the way. So, you know, more the fun to us. And
yeah.
I think it was the same with the ancient Greeks. Like, you know, they sensed their inconsistencies, but I think they enjoyed them and they played with them. And this is what makes Greek mythology so fascinating to us today as well.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I think they were just so aware. And I think it's just so interesting coming at it from, you know, like our modern perspective, because it's been so affected by modern religion that it's so hard, I think, to separate ourselves and like imagine what it would be like back then. But I do think that, yeah, they were just more like, this is just kind of the way it is. And sometimes it doesn't make sense. And like, but isn't that fun? You know?
Yeah, it's life.
Yeah. So, I mean, I just want to hear like literally everything to do with any of that. But like, so you work mostly in sources like Homer and Hesiod, you were saying, right? So
that's correct.
Really,
yeah.
Ancient. Yeah. So, I mean, what does that look like? Say, I mean, even just between those two sources, like there's so many different things that are consistent and then not. And yeah, I mean, I just want to hear everything, and I can't form a question other than everything.
Okay, so I might try to just discuss one of my favorite examples, which
Please.
Is divine immortality or lack thereof.
Yes.
Yeah, because, you know, this is actually quite a significant difference between Homer and Hesiod, at least in my approach. Mm. Because, for instance, for Hesiod, the gods are immortal. And you can see that very clearly in Theogony. I mean, you can't kill a god. You can only stash a god into Tartarus or bind them in some way. So, you know, it's very visible that Hesiod does not like the idea of deicide, of god killing. And he tries to sort of make it sure that the gods stay somewhere and they aren't really killed. Whereas, for instance, in Homer, in the Iliad, this is a very funny thing. Like, for instance, we get the book 5 when, you know, we get Ares who gets wounded and Aphrodite as well. And of course, you could argue that Athena helps things along, that she enchants the spear that wounds Ares. But at the same time, you can tell that in this book, you know, and in the Iliad as a larger work, there is this idea that mortality is the defining feature of heroes. It's the end and the means of heroism, because if you can die, I mean, your existence has some meaning because it can end in every moment. And I think it extends in some strange way towards the gods, because, you know, they are also faced maybe not with death itself, but with mortal pain, with mortal difficulties. And we have these fascinating fragments, for instance, in book 5, when we see that Ares was imprisoned in a bronze jar
right.
by the giants Autus and Ephialtes. And Homer explicitly says, although, you know, many classicists don't like this passage because it's so problematic, but Homer explicitly says, and he would have perished there had he not been released.
Right.
You know, so it's very hypothetical. We are using, you know, the hypotheticals. But it looks like, you know, Homer seemed to show in a very guarded way that, you know, that gods can have a very unpleasant brush with death in some very, very specific circumstances. And I've been thinking about this for a very long time, and I found out that this idea of sort of divine vulnerability crops up in many places in the Greek mythological corpus. It's always very controversial. People don't like to talk about this, but it does surface from time to time. So this is one of these ideas that the Greeks maybe thought it was blasphemous, but at the same time, they just couldn't get rid of it. It just was floating there in the background, inspiring them all the same.
Yeah. What are some other examples of that? Like, yeah, that's so interesting.
For instance, you know, building on this idea, so what is a god? So we think we have a set of assumptions about the gods that by and large go unexamined. For instance, we think that if the gods have children, then their children will be gods as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is my favorite nonsense.
Yeah, like which is not, you know, it doesn't make sense. Like, and I think that becoming a god is by many, in many exam scenarios, a very happy happenstance, you know, that you are never quite sure. And there is a wonderful book by Emily Vermeil called the, I think it's called Death in Early Greek Art and Poetry. Mm. Yes, that's true. And basically she has a chapter within called The Mortal Immortals. And within the book, she sort of draws our attention to all these specific situations within the Greek mythology when you have a character who isn't certain whether he or she is mortal or immortal. And for instance, she draws our attention to Geryon, one of Heracles' opponents, who has a very interesting family history because he is grandson of Medusa. And Medusa herself, you know, is a wonderful character because we learn from Hesiod, at least, that she descends from a very old divine family. Her parents are gods, and her sisters are explicitly said to be immortal, but she, for some reason, turns out to be mortal. And, you know, Hesiod's wording in this passage is so wonderfully ambiguous. Like, it looks to me, at least, like this is something that just happened to her. Like, it wasn't expected. This wasn't part of her family. But also, you know, I infer from that she didn't know about this. So she wasn't aging. She showed no obvious signs of aging. And then Perseus comes and lops off her head. And then suddenly, wow, she dies. Like, it wasn't expected. But at the same time, further on, the story goes that Medusa, of course, has a child with Poseidon. She was raped by Poseidon. And she has, obviously, Pegasus and Chrysaor. And, you know, these children continue this idea, like, you know, they aren't certain whether they are mortal or immortal. Nobody tries to kill them. So, you know, there is this ultimate test by trial, you know, by physical violence. You can tell whether somebody is truly immortal or not. But they sort of hang at the edges and they are never certain. But Chrysaor goes on and he has a child with an Okeanid, Caliroe. And then their child, this is a three-bodied Geryon, Heracles' opponent. And in Stesichorus wrote a poem about Geryon, which survives only in fragments, which I think is terrible, but because I would really love to read it. But from we have, it seems that Geryon had a conversation with somebody, either his friend or his mother, and they discussed the issue of his immortality. And from what we have, it suggests like Geryon says, I am not sure whether I am immortal or not. We've never really checked. And, you know, this his interlocutor, whether his mother or his friend, says, you shouldn't try because you never know. If you don't try, it might be that you will live forever. But if you are wounded by Heracles, you will die. But Geryon, you know, he has this dilemma and he says, well, I need to be a brave one. I need to face my opponent head on. And he does. And there is this wonderful yet very sad comparison that Heracles strikes him a blow and his head falls down as if a poppy sheds its flowers down. And, you know, it loses its head on the ground. So it's a very sad story, but it shows, like, you know, at least Stesichorus, he liked to entertain this idea that sometimes there are beings who aren't quite certain. They might not age, but they could die if attacked. And I think that there is an entire class of beings like that in Greek mythology, even those who traditionally would be considered gods, that, you know, they are long-lived, they are immortal if they aren't attacked. But if they are attacked, you know, all bets are off. Nobody knows what's going to happen. And I think this could be one of the reasons why the gods, at least for instance in the Iliad, do not like being attacked. Because they don't know what's going to happen. Like, you know, it's never true whether you know, whether your immortality is going to prevail or not. It looks like it usually, but there is this always this, you know, little bit of doubt. What's going to happen? Is death going to come or not? And I think this is really fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. This idea that they're like immortal, but not necessarily invulnerable. Like,
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, also the lack of Stesichorus broadly is very depressing because the fragments that we have are always so fun. But just that we have a character who actually asks that, like I wasn't aware of that. And I'm kind of obsessed with it now because there's something so different about actually asking the question versus, yeah, just like letting it all be left unsaid all the time. Because, I mean, the Children of Gods are an absolutely fascinating concept because there are no rules. It's like sometimes you're a god, sometimes you're not. Like, what makes the difference? Like, my own kind of pet obsession is Harmonia and Cadmus. But Harmonia is so fascinating because she's the daughter of Aphrodite and Ares. Like, this explicit child of not just like two divinities, but two Olympians. And yet we don't have a single thing about her being a god in any way other than just that she was born of these people. But then she goes and like lives this mortal life. But we don't actually, now that you've said this, now I'm thinking about it in a different way, because we don't actually know that she died, because at the end, Ares turns her into a snake with Cadmus. So it's like, after all of that, she could have been a goddess this whole time and she could have lived on forever if that hadn't happened.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then, of course, there's, like, other children of Ares and Aphrodite who are, like, full-blown, like, divine beings. Like, usually they're just kind of personification gods, but, like, they're gods.
And I have a question for you here.
Yes!
So what is the difference between Harmonia and different children of Aphrodite and Ares?
Yeah, I mean, like, I don't even know. But, like, they're...
So I have a theory here. Like, look where they live. Harmonia goes on to live among humans.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, yeah. And I think this matters. Like, you know, immortality is also connected with your dwelling. Like, if you're on Olympus, then you get this little ontological check that it says you are among the gods, yes. And we the gods as a society, we accept and we confirm your godhood. But if you are exiled and live among humans, you know, the rules are starting to get blurry and nobody really knows. And I think the same holds, for instance, for Circe, for Medea, for Circe's brother Aetes, who are the children of the sun, and by all means they should be gods, but they live on earth and they adopt mortal mannerisms and, you know, they behave pretty much like humans do, with some small differences, but still. And they occupy this weird in-between indeterminate position between gods and humans. And we know we're there, but they are never tested, like, you know, by violence. We don't know what's going to happen if they're actually attacked. Although we kind of do in the Odyssey. You remember that famous scene when Odysseus attacks Circe with a sword and she screams.
Yeah.
She starts running around. So it looks to me like she knows that this is something that could potentially hurt her.
Yeah. Oh, that's really interesting. But now it has me thinking of like where everybody else lives. But yeah, I mean, I guess even if you go to divine beings, like say, you know, you were talking about Medusa. Like the Gorgons, the other two Gorgons are immortal, but they do live like beyond Oceanus. So presumably that's, some kind of like immortal realm. And then everyone else, it's interesting because it's sort of like often unspecified. Like, I guess we just assume they're all on Olympus and then it can fit everybody. But then, yeah. Oh, that's really interesting. I love that a lot. Because I just love that it doesn't make any sense, but I also love these kind of theorizing on how it could make sense. It's just not explicit.
Yeah, because this is the problem with this kind asking these kinds of questions. I like to think of myself as a theologian or a theologist, whatever you call that. But these kinds of questions are not asked by classicists widely because they are very difficult to answer, and there is nothing in the text which explicitly says, you know, these are the classes of beings within the Greek mythology. And I think this is the problem, that you all have to infer this stuff. And, you know, maybe it was obvious to the ancient Greeks. Maybe it was borne out in the sources and they just instinctively knew. So these are the classes of the beings we have in the universe and they have such and such features. You kind of can see start of the theorizing in philosophical works later on, like Plato and all that. They start to sort of arrange the cosmos and say, so these are the kinds of spirits and beings and they inhabit these and these spheres. So we can see that, but you obviously cannot extrapolate that and say that this is equal to the worldview of Homer and Hesiod about the gods.
Mm-hmm.
But you can say, so basically the impulse was there, and if you use the contextual cues within the text and you see how the gods behave within the text, you can sort of see, okay, so this is the kind of rule they obey, so it must mean something. if, you know, if there is a broadly a trend here, and then you can try to extrapolate and see what's going to happen in the different scenarios when it doesn't quite fit. So it's always, you know, it's never perfect, but I would say that there are some broad trends here and you can try to sort of use them to predict what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Lots of interesting things. I just love thinking about the gods in all of these different ways and just the sources too. Like, I mean, clearly I love it. It's literally all I do every day.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity. It's designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals to help cover unexpected expenses, plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. In other words, it's like getting a paycheck for life. We'll say that again. A paycheck for life. Guaranteed. Sounds too good to be true? It's not. It's the Parity Flex annuity. And it's one more example of their commitment to creating a better financial future for women. One where they feel empowered, not excluded, and ready to take on whatever their next chapter holds. Gainbridge believes financial flexibility and security are things we all could use more of. At retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Who's with us? Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Please visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, for product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.
Hi, I'm Cindy Crawford, and I'm the founder of Meaningful Beauty. Well, I don't know about you, but like, I never liked being told, oh, wow, you look so good for your age. Like, why even bother saying that? Why don't you just say you look great at any age, every age? That's what Meaningful Beauty is all about. We create products that make you feel confident in your skin at the age you are now.
Meaningful Beauty. Beautiful skin at every age. Learn more at meaningfulbeauty.com.
We went from normal life, healthy child to acute lymphoblastic leukemia or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Okay, demigods, quote unquote. I'm so curious about your thoughts on them because, I mean, from my perspective, like, I've always just found them interesting because it's another one of those cases where a lot, like, I feel like there are rules, but they don't always align. But also the term demigod has always been something that I don't know why I don't like it, but I explicitly don't like it and I don't use it. And I think it's purely because of how it doesn't totally make sense, because like sometimes there is a something that makes one a demigod in terms of like their abilities or immortality or what have you. And then often there's like seemingly nothing. And so to me, it like shouldn't be a class. it's just kind of a question mark. And anyway, I would love to hear any and all thoughts.
Oh, yes. And I would love to talk about it. So, but first, I think we have to go back and ask ourselves, what is a god and what makes a god in Greek mythology?
Okay.
And, you know, I have a working theory in that, you know, obviously, you know, the gods have this kind of immortality, whether it's vulnerable or not, they do not die on their own. They also have eternal youth, which is quite obvious, with some exceptions, but let's just keep it here. And then you have this kind of power. The gods have something with which the Greeks have usually expressed are their time or their moira. So this is their part and this is their honor. But, you know, if you follow Jean-Pierre Vernant and this French structuralist, they would say to you that this is the expression of a god's signature, their power that differentiates them from all the different gods in the world. And this is a part that is given to only them. And, you know, by extension, this is a kind of a power that they wield in the world. Like, you know, obviously, you know, Demeter grows grain and Apollo, you know, is with the prophecy and Poseidon, you know, rules over the oceans. I mean, the sea, not the oceans. Okay, this is clear here. But, you know, well, when you start thinking about this, so let's say, okay, so you have gods and they have these three features. They have immortality, eternal youth, and they have this kind of power over the world. And then you have humans who have none. You know, they are mortal, they age, and they don't have any special powers. And then you cross these two genres. And what happens? Like, you know, obviously, humans keep their aging, keep their mortality. And usually, you know, in the sources we have, humans do not inherit any special powers, usually. Mm-hmm. And here we go back to this very idea of a demigod, which you are very clear and right to dislike, because I've read up on the sources, and there is a wonderful article by Professor Ruth Scodell, who analyzes the textual history of the idea of a demigod. And it seems like that the Greeks never explicitly used that word in the way we use it. Like, for instance, for us, the demigod is very, you know, biological. So mm-hmm. this is an offspring of a deity and a human being. So, okay. But the Greeks used that in a much more vague way, in that they said, for instance, they could use, they never used the compound itself, at least at the very beginning, but they tended to say that these are the heroes and they are perfect and they are illustrious. So, for instance, you find that in Hesiod that, for instance, some people say that if you have these illustrious heroes who are descended from the gods, then they can sort of become daimones after their death and they will guard, you know, the races of the humans. So basically, you have this idea that there's something that stays in you when you have a divine parent, but it's never explicitly, you know, expressed. It's never said what it is. You know, here is the one of the other places when you don't have any explicit definitions, and I really regret that. But if you go later on in the material, then you start to sort of see that basically maybe they don't use this term per se, but they do express the idea that if you have a divine parent, that something of this parent stays with you. And it's by no means, you know, it never happens in the Iliad. Like, you know, it's not like we imagine ourselves, for instance, in Percy Jackson, that if your father is Poseidon, you will get powers over water. That doesn't really work like that, but it's a shade of the idea. For instance, in the Hesiodic corpus, you have descriptions of many children of Ares. And it's not said like they have any special power over the war. But it is said that they behave insolently and they are very hard to be around. So, you know, it's sort of like, you know, you do inherit a kind of a character. And then you go to characters like Odysseus's grandfather, Autolycus, you know, on his mother's side, who is a renowned cattle thief. And he had this wonderful power to sort of change their skin so that nobody would recognize their own cattle after he had their way with them, basically. And here, you know, the Greeks wanted to explain this ability somehow, and they theorized. And some people say, oh, obviously he was Hermes' protege, so he gave him this power. But other people, and there's quite a lot of them, other sources, they say he was Hermes' son. Mm-hmm. This is an inherited power. And basically, you can see this wavering in a lot of places in Greek mythology, that if you have a character who has a special power, sometimes people say, well, this has been gifted to them by their tutelary deity. Other people say, this has been inherited. So I would say that there are two paradigms warring in the minds of ancient Greeks, that sometimes things are inherited and sometimes things are gifted. And even more interestingly, sometimes you can inherit things that are gifted. They stay with you generation after generation. For instance, the gifts of prophecy, which are associated with certain families, they are gifted at the very beginning, but then they pass down across the generations.
That's really interesting. I just was reading a section of the Metamorphoses where Odysseus is fighting over Achilles' armor, and he goes into how his family has all these immortal connections. And I feel like before that, I'd kind of forgotten about the Hermes connection. And then as soon as you're saying it, I'm like, oh, right. Yeah. Like, he's got Hermes on his mother's side. And that's yeah. So I love the cattle story. I need to look into that one more. Yeah, that's really, really fascinating. So like, generationally, like, I'm trying to think of the prophetic people you could be referring to. But I
could find it up for you if you want to, because I have them somewhere.
I mean, only if it's easy. Don't worry too much. But
it is easy, okay. Because, you know, let me just have a look. Okay, so I do have an example. For instance, we have Pindar, who sings of Yamus, who is the mythical founder of Mantic clan of the Yamidae, who invoked Poseidon, his grandfather, and Apollo, his father, to reveal his destiny to him. And Apollo answered his prayer and taught him the art of prophecy. Although teachable, this gifted skill allegedly could be mastered only by Yamus's descendants, as Pindar says. So this is a very specific example of this kind of inheritance of a gift.
Yeah, story. That's so explicit. That's like, nope, you can only get it if it's inherited. Oh, I love that.
Yeah, and you can kind of see why, you know, like, he was fighting for the honor of the family of the Yamidae. Like, basically, they are saying, this is copyrighted, you can't fake this.
Yeah, exactly. Like, no, you can't, you can't pretend. Like, this is just ours.
Yeah, and basically, you know, there is another interesting story with what happens with inheritance. Like, for instance, have you ever wondered what happens when a deity and a human being have a child in Greek mythology? So this child is, I don't know, you don't like this term, but a demigod, a hybrid, so to speak. And this hybrid goes into, you know, a relationship with another deity. So what we have then, a three-quarters god? And, you know, I ask myself, like, you know, how far can you take this kind of thinking? And it turned out, weirdly enough, that the Greeks seem to recognize that this divine feature can accumulate generation after generation, because, for instance, I've recorded five examples, the most well-known ones, of a characters when a demigod or a demigoddess mates with a god or a goddess. And they are all in Hesiod. They aren't, you know, like, you know, very clear if you don't know what you're looking for. But, for instance, one of them, obviously you've mentioned Harmonia and Cadmus. So Harmonia, you know, has a child who is Dionysus's mother, Semele, who is technically a demigoddess. And she has a child with Zeus, who is Dionysus. So Dionysus technically is three-quarters god, one-quarter human, which is just so fun because it's just so clear for Dionysus and just so fits him. Like, he would have this mortal part within him. And even though, you know, some may say it's burnt out, you know, by his whole miraculous conception and then birth. But still, you know, he has this familial connection. Like, he is a god who has been born out of his human ancestry. But weirdly enough, when you look at Dionysus' wife, Ariadne, let's look at her family.
Right.
Story.
Yeah, there's so much in there, her mother? Too. Yeah,
her mother is
Pasiphae, who,
the daughter of the sun. Yeah. So she is a goddess, technically, but still, you know, she's a goddess. Nobody says elsewhere, you know, anyway.
Yeah.
So she's a goddess, and his father is Minos, who is the son of Zeus and Europa, so a demigod. So a goddess meets a demigod, they fall in love, and they have Ariadne.
Yes.
So she's also three quarters. And isn't it weird that three quarters god and three quarters goddess meet and, you know, enter this marriage?
Well, and like all of that, and the fact that they are, this is great timing. I literally put down my computer writing about Dionysus and Ariadne to get on this call with you. But because she's also the only one who gets fully deified. Like,
exactly.
Yeah, he's the only part mortal god who then also marries a mortal, well, quote unquote mortal. And then she gets full blown deified, which is.
The potential was in her all along.
Yes. Oh my God. I'm also in the middle of reading a novel that my friend is having published about Dionysus and Ariadne, and I'm going to text them immediately after this. But it's, yeah, that's so interesting. And Dionysus has always been a favorite of mine. I mean, for countless reasons, wine being a big one, but also just like, he is so interesting because of his mother being Semele. And honestly, I cringe at that idea you mentioned of, you know, if his mortality being burned out of him. Like, I think there's this subset of Dionysus origin stories that really want to erase Semele. And it's weird to me because I think, like, not only is it offensive, you know, for Zeus to be like, he's only mine, but also it's so much more interesting to see Dionysus as being, you know, like you said, three quarters God.
But it's the same with Athena, right? Nobody likes to remember
exactly
that she had a mother.
Oh, yes. And I get just as offended about poor Metis. But with Dionysus, too, like, it explains so much about his personality, and it explains so much about the stories that he's then given. You know, he's young, and yet he's old, and he's foreign, but he's Theban, and he gets to be so many things. And I think him having this, like, mortal family line just makes him so much more interesting, and it really fits everything else about him that makes him this sort of weird god. You know, he stands out in so many ways, and having that mortality be one of those ways is just so much more interesting. But then this connection to Ariadne too, and her being right. So divine. It's so difficult because, like, particularly with her parents, say, there are examples of really common tropes in Greek mythology, which is that these people are descended from gods really directly, and yet are not given any kind of explicit divine nature. You know, like, Minos and Pasiphae might as well be mortal for all that we're told about them, other than their parentage. And yet, yeah, we still have to, like, you still look at the fact that they're both the children of gods and say, like, okay, well, what could that mean? That's so...
Although with Pasiphae, I would have to disagree. Like, you know, we have a very late source. I think it's Antoninus Liberalis. But if I remember correctly, you know, there is this very nasty story that, you know, Minos was being unfaithful.
Oh, the snakes!
Yes, and she cast a charm that he would ejaculate snakes and scorpions. So she's clearly having some sort of a magical power.
So true. So true. Yes. Oh, thank you for reminding
me
of
that. And she, you know, it's explicitly said in the source that, but she being immortal, she was, you know, wouldn't come to harm from that.
Yeah.
She only was immune to that.
I guess also there's something to be said for the fact that she gave birth to a minotaur. Like,
exactly.
Yeah.
Because technically it's half animal and half god.
Yeah. Yeah.
Technically.
Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful.
And here we have another question. Why do all the weird creatures and beings of Greek mythology, after several generations, they always default to humanity?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, the magic goes away after some time?
But I love this idea of it's where they're living. Like, that idea that Harmonia is less divine because she's just living on Earth.
Because the gods don't just do this. Like, you know, it's not very seemly to go live among the humans. Like, you don't get access to ambrosia and nectar.
Yeah.
And you're seen as a third-rate sort of relative who's been exiled. Which is, you know, a motive, I think, in Madeline Miller's Circe as well, that she's been exiled to her island
right,
as well.
Yeah.
And I think this sort of, there's this very vital idea in Greek mythology. So where you live and the company you keep makes you who you are.
Yeah. I love these parts of conversations because I'm just taking everything in. But, like, I mean, I just, now I'm trying to think of other things about Pasiphae too, because I know also Diodorus Siculus, I forget if it's a lot about her. I know he is where we get some really interesting stuff about Medea's more divine natures. But I'm trying to think of what there is about Pasiphae too, because the snakes bit. Oh, that's...
Yeah, but you know, this whole family is wonderful.
Yes.
And I actually, you know, I devoted my BA to studying the descendants of Helios because I think they're a great family.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I had this moment like last year where it occurred to me for the first time why they live in the east, and I just was like, it's just where the sun comes from. Like, just that alone was the most fun realization on my end, because in my head I'm like, why are they not Greek? And then it's like, oh no, it's literally they're just where the sun is, obviously.
Yeah,
it's one of those moments where you're just like, oh right, the most obvious answer is it, and that's the most fun too. Like, it's so practical.
Yeah, exactly. And it makes such a lot of sense to the Greeks. Like, you know, this is their parents, so obviously they are living where the sun rises.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like, well, duh. Yeah. Like, where else would they be?
You know, as Emilie Vermeule says it, they live in the enchanted spaces at the edge where nothing goes right and everything is different than in the human realm.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh.
They do have this fairy tale quality to them, but at the same time, you know, they are a very powerful family, because if you would consider Hesiod and his Theogony, at the end, when Zeus is tying up all the loose genealogical ends and he's marrying all these goddesses, suddenly you get this weird little family. Like, you know, you have this ant that refuses to be put away, Helios. And he marries his, you know, Achaeanid, you know, Perseus, and he keeps having children. And these children keep having immortal children, or at least those weird children. And it never stops. And Zeus has to do something about this. So, you know, all their children end badly in some way. And it's, you know, there is this wonderful PhD dissertation by Evelyn Bracke, who basically says that this is a familial offshoot of the divine tree that was too dangerous to be left alone. And Zeus had to do something about it. So, you know, he sends mortal heroes. He sends Odysseus. He sends, you know, Jason to just sort of do some spring cleaning and just get rid of these floating weird god pseudo magical things that are there at the edges of the pantheon. And he sort of gets rid of them. But until that happens, you know, their stories are so wonderful. I mean, the family of Helios gets entangled in the Odyssey, in the Argonautica. They have connections to so many different gods. I mean, we are told many different and weird details. Like, for instance, in the Argonautica, we are told that Helios had some sort of understanding with Hephaestus, possibly because of the fact that Helios warned Hephaestus about Aphrodite having an affair with Ares.
Right.
And, you know, it's taken further, and it said that, you know, that Hephaestus was grateful, and he not only gave Helios some of his, you know, shiny things to write the sky, but he also gave children of Helios, like Aeetes, wonderful bronze automata, and his palace in the far east, and Colchis. So we can sort of see that there are so many familial connections, and they are have, you know, ties to all the great divinities of Olympus, but yet they choose to live at the edges, and they have this sort of indeterminate, we like them, we don't like them status relationship with the Olympians. So there is so much to discover. And obviously their magic, which is, I think, their most wonderful and familiar feature. Like Circe is a witch, Medea is a witch. And, you know, we can sort of theorize that Aeetes was a wizard as well, because he did things that no mortal does. But then you can argue, well, they are gods, but they also use these kind of weird powers that they don't look like divine powers as well. So there is just so much to unpack here about the divine magic and what they are doing.
Yeah, they're really unique. That reminds me of, again, I think this is Diodorus Siculus, but he says, he gives this idea that Hecate is Medea's mother, I think it is. Like, she's with Aeetes. And I find that interesting. Like, it almost feels like a way to explain what was already there. You know, like these witchy qualities that you're just mentioning, like the ways that they're divine, but they are like different. They use their divinity.
And you remember this example with Hermes as well, right? Mm-hmm. So some people say it's gifted, some people say it's in family.
Right.
So I think it's the same here. Like, you know, he's just wondering.
Yeah.
Where do they come from?
Exactly. Yeah. He's like, he's kind of making this further connection that makes it more explicit why they would, you know, have those specific abilities. Yeah. Okay.
Do you know how they are different, actually, these abilities?
No, like not other than just them being pharmaca, like, or in magic related.
Like, yeah, so I have a working theory here, and well, I could just talk about it very briefly. So
please.
I think that the difference is that when the god uses a power, or a god or a goddess uses their power, it's their own power. Whereas when you are using pharmaca or anything else, you are using an external focus. You add something to your power. And it's very clear with both Circe and Medea. Like, Medea uses this flower who grows from the blood of Prometheus and all these different salves and stuff. Whereas Circe also uses potions and she has a wand. So it looks like there is this idea that the gods, you know, they can do on their own. You know, they just use their power and it works. Whereas a witch or a wizard, well, they need something extra.
Yeah.
Like, they need an external focus to their power. They need to mix their own power with something else.
Yeah. Oh, that's really interesting.
No!
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity. It's designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals to help cover unexpected expenses, plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. In other words, it's like getting a paycheck for life. We'll say that again. A paycheck for life. Guaranteed. Sounds too good to be true? It's not. It's the Parity Flex annuity. And it's one more example of their commitment to creating a better financial future for women. One where they feel empowered, not excluded, and ready to take on whatever their next chapter holds. Gainbridge believes financial flexibility and security are things we all could use more of. At retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Who's with us? Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Please visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.
Hi, I'm Cindy Crawford, and I'm the founder of Meaningful Beauty. Well, I don't know about you, but like, I never liked being told, oh, wow, you look so good for your age. Like, why even bother saying that? Why don't you just say you look great at any age, every age? That's what Meaningful Beauty is all about. We create products that make you feel confident in your skin at the age you are now.
Meaningful Beauty. Beautiful skin at every age. Learn more at meaningfulbeauty.com.
We went from normal life, healthy child, to acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com, that's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Okay, hearing about all of this too just made me so curious about the divinities that kind of exist on the other side. So, you know, the Gorgons, the Grey Eye, specifically the Grey Eye, because I think that they make no sense in the best way. And I'm curious if you have any thoughts on them, because they are bizarre, you know. And to explain to my listeners, just a reminder of like, them and the Gorgons are all, they're like two sets of, usually sometimes three sisters each. They're all children of sea deities, like explicitly water-based deities. And yet they all three have like seemingly no association to the water. There's like that connection with the Grey Eye being like, oh, they, them being gray is connected to the waves of the sea and something like that. But otherwise, they like live on land and they don't have any explicit connection to the water. And I'm just so curious what your thoughts are on them.
Well, there are two possible ways, I think, at least to approach this. One of them is something that was told to me by Jenny Strauss Clay, and I think it makes a lot of sense. She says that basically, you know, when you have the marriage of Gaia and Uranus, so the heavens and the earth, this is the marriage that produces those gods that we deem as normal, as normative, as somehow what we think they should be. But when we have these other marriages, like with the earth and the sea, then this is the place where you can do some experiments, mental experiments. And she says this is the place when you chuck everything which doesn't fit, which is just gleefully, you know, recycling motives and seeing what's going to stick. And to join with this with something I've been thinking about, like, for instance, many of the creatures of the Greek mythology are, you know, very simple experiments, but they are also very wonderful in that you take something that you know and you flip one of its features and then it suddenly becomes something wondrous. And the gray are like this. So, you know, they are ever young, but they have gray hair. You know, and they, you know, they should be, you know, they should have their eye, but they have to share it. So, you know, it's like this idea, like, you know, sometimes you have beings which have multiple bodies, like Geryon, who also descends from that family. Mm. And sometimes you have beings who have to share something because they don't have enough. So I would say this is an inverse of that idea. This is another thought experiment the Greeks were so fond of, to see what would happen if you would have this kind of being. What would happen if you made a horse the human? What would happen if you made, you know, this with that? You would get Chimera. You would get this kind of dog. And it's all in this weird family of the sea where you stash these monsters. Obviously, the same goes for the family of Nyx, the knight, who is also very keen on bringing these weird creatures out of herself. So I would say, like, you know, the marriage of Gaia and Uranus, this is where you have the usual stuff. But the rest, you know, all rules are off. You can have whatever you want.
Yeah. Ooh, I like that. And it makes so much sense, too, especially when you, like, it is so explicitly connected to the sea. Because I like to think of, like, the reality parts, too, right? Like, the fact that everything they would have seen from the ocean would have been mysterious as all hell and weird. Because it even is to us today. Like, there's, you know, like, if there's one most mysterious thing in place in the world, it is the bottom of the ocean. And so, yeah, the idea that, like, well, everything weird, or not everything, but a number of weird things can be linked back to that is, it just makes sense.
Right. To the scene. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Now we're talking about weird things. What are your thoughts on the Hecatonchires?
Oh, you know, they are very interesting. Like, you know, they are parts of these early beings. And I would also say that, yes, they technically come from Gaia and Uranus, but at the same time, you know, they are some of these early generations, like the Cyclopes and all that. And I would say that basically Gaia, at different stages of her life, was bringing forth very different children. And you have this main line which sort of tapers down to the gods we know and we think are the norm. And then you have these offshoots of things when she tried to do something slightly different. And you can sort of see that, you know, she's trying very hard to produce these normal human anthropomorphic children. But at the same time, you know, sometimes, you know, she reverts and she then splits something different. Like, for example, Hecatonchires here. And I would say that, you know, there are some prophecies about them. And you can see it in Hesiod. Like, you know, they are said to be the key to defeating the Titans and all that. So you can sort of see that. Even within this very ordered kind of universe that Zeus tries to impose upon the world, you still need this element of wildness. And I think perhaps this is also why he retains the Cyclopes as his thunderbolt makers, that it is clearly said that these weird creatures have a place. They need to be included. You need to co-opt them, because if you don't, they will go away and they will start doing their own thing, and you might not like it what they're going to do.
Yeah. Yeah. Zeus certainly seems to be the one who's like, who knows how to intelligently use, or not intelligently, but like strategically use characters like the Cyclops and the Hecatonchires, because that he's also, because he gets to see what Kronos did and how badly it went, and then be like, okay, well, yeah. I can see why, you know, that's not how I should handle it. Because even the...
Yeah, but he also had a lot of help from Themis, right?
Oh, for sure. I mean, Zeus does nothing on his own. And I... apologies to anyone for making it seem like I think that Zeus could do anything. But yeah, I mean, I think what Zeus is good at doing is utilizing everybody else's intelligence.
Delegating, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, between like the fact that he literally ate Metis, I think this... some good examples on just how much he doesn't do for himself, and then makes everyone think they're all for himself.
Yes, because, well, he was quite smart, because this was the first time when Kutkev actually lost his power, right?
Yeah.
There was this prophecy that she was supposed to bring a child after Athena, and it would be a boy, and he would dethrone him. So he ate her. But it wasn't so simple in case of Thetis, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But that story is crazy for me. And, you know, I've published two chapters on Thetis, and I still think there is so much to say about this goddess. She is one of the most interesting and intriguing beings in the entire pantheon, and we don't really know that much about her, but whenever she appears in the sources, like, she just is wow. Like, you know, it's something grand that's going to happen here.
Yeah. Did you write for that book that came out on her recently?
I was the editor.
Okay, well, there you go. Because yeah. I had on... Was David Wright was talking about her, right? Okay, good.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, he was my co-editor.
Okay, great.
You know, I co-edited with David and with Gary Voss.
Beautiful. I just have so many guests on and I'm like, I'm 99% sure if it was David, but if I'm wrong, I would feel really bad. But he was telling me all about that book, and like, Thetis is so exciting. I would love to hear any thoughts. Even before you mentioned her, I was going to lead this to, I want to hear what your thoughts are on, like, you know, we mentioned this concept of demigod, but I'm so fascinated by like the heroes with and without divine parents and like what that does and does not give them, like Achilles being obviously one of the most interesting. But I also am always obligated to say that here in my little town of Victoria and the farthest reaches of Canada, we do have a lake that's called Thetis and it is named for her.
Wow.
It is
wonderful.
It's cool. It's named for her through like some British colonial ship, whatever, but it's still named for her.
And I think she deserves a lake at least.
She does. Absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, I would love to hear more about her generally, because I the little bits I've heard from a couple of guests have brought her up, because she is this like quite mysterious character, and that she has so much more importance and power than the other Nereids. And yet, we don't really have like any kind of definitive reason for why, unless there's something more. But like, yes, tell me everything about her, basically.
So basically, we find her in all sorts of weird places. Like, we have her genealogy, and basically she's said to descend from Nereus and Doris, obviously. So part from Nereus, part from Okeanos. So she mixes sweet and salty waters. So this is already interesting.
Yeah.
But this is also true for her sister, so that wouldn't explain it. But then we see that Hera, at least in the Homer, Hera says that she adopted her and she raised her on Olympus. So already we see she was picked up for some reason, like, you know, Hera picked her out of the other Nereids. And then we see, for instance, that, well, she has a very unusual biography, and that she lives on Olympus, she grows up, then she becomes very beautiful, and she attracts, as Pindar says, eyes of Zeus and Poseidon. And this is a very, very fraught and difficult moment in Greek mythology, because both Zeus and Poseidon want to marry her. And at this moment, Zeus was probably Hera's husband already. So you can imagine the row it caused. And, you know, Pindar describes this wonderfully in his ode, like, you know, the immortals almost went to war over Thetis. But then Themis comes and she advises Zeus he should not marry her, because she will have a child who is stronger than his father. And then Zeus reconsiders. And then, you know, something very weird says, because, you know, when you ask, when you see what the different authors say, and even what different characters say in the same work, then the motivations of Thetis are always very unclear, in that we know that she didn't marry Zeus, but we don't know why. For instance, Hera says, oh, she did this because she's my favorite stepdaughter, and she did this to refuse Zeus because she obeys my will. So obviously this is something Hera would say. And then, you know, Zeus says that she was stubborn and willful, and she disrespected me, she disobeyed me. But then, you know, you start wondering, Thetis says nothing about this. Like, you know, we know that she refused, but we don't know why. And this is the first time, I think, where her silence is becoming so important. And then there's this weird moment when it looks like Thetis is exiled from Olympus. She's no longer living there. She goes to live, at least what we see in the Homeric hymn to Apollo, in the sea with her aunt, Eurynome, who is also a fascinating character, because, you know, she was worshipped, as Pausanias says, as this half-fish, half-woman figure who is bound with golden chains. So basically, and she also crops up in certain narratives as a goddess who created the world, at least according to certain versions of Orphic mythology. Ugh, so Thetis keeps company with this powerful creator goddess. She lives under the sea. And then, you know, Hera has this whole shtick with Hephaestus, because she bears him. She doesn't like him. So she disposes of him. She throws him into the sea, and Thetis rescues him. She raises him, and it looks like she teaches him everything he knows.
Yeah.
Like, he becomes a god who forges with fire under the water, which is just such a wonderful image. And it will later be reverberated in certain of Thetis's transformations, that she turns into fire and water as well. So you have this wonderful duality here. And then there is another story, that Dionysus leaps into the sea because he is being persecuted, and Thetis also saves him.
Yeah.
And when you look about this, you know, you have these two stories, and I looked at them, okay, so what do they have in common? And then I realized that Hephaestus is the one who produces ties and binds. He's the one who chains other gods. Dionysus is the loosener, the one who releases you. And, you know, that makes such a lot of sense, but it makes you think. So Thetis raised two gods who are basically two functions of the universe. They are so powerful, and she is their stepmother. And just think about the favors she's owed and the power she has, the clandestine power. She has to go and ask for it, but still, you know, she has connections all over Olympus. And then, obviously, you know, she continues living in the sea, but at some point, Zeus has to tie this loose end as well. And he designates his grandson, Peleus, and he tells him that he has to rape her. And I don't want to gloss over it, because this is very true, and I think it was visible in the sources that Thetis was raped by Peleus. She did not enjoy this at all. She was caught by him, and I think she was bound with something.
Yeah.
Because, you know, do you think, like, could a mortal defeat a goddess? Like, you know, how would this happen? And I have a working theory that he had something that would help him. We don't know what that was, but I think it might have been a chain or something. But there's a lot of symbolism of chains and being bound in this story.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, Thetis yields. She is raped and she's impregnated with Achilles. But this is not the end of the story. Like, you know, Thetis knows that as long as she is, you know, she's pregnant, she has this child, her great power, the prophecy that was about her, that she would bring a son that would be more powerful than his father, is not being fulfilled. So she tries to unbind herself by immortalizing Achilles. And you do have this in some late sources, for example, in the Organatica, and I think Lycophron as well, that Thetis did these experiments with her children, because some people say that Peleus, you know, had more children with Thetis rather than just Achilles.
Yeah.
And she would boil them in fire or, you know, put them in fire or try to put them into boiling water and see what's going to happen. Like, and, you know, we see that a very different face of Thetis here, because in the Iliad, she's like this grieving mother who is very, you know, not very powerful and she cries a lot. But here we see, you know, like this mad scientist who's doing experiment on her own child to see whether it's going to survive or not. And if it doesn't, well, she can always get more, because she keeps getting raped by Peleus, right? So this is such a macabre story and such crazy details here. But then eventually you see that Thetis does this ritual, and I think it comes closest to actually immortalizing Achilles when she anoints him with ambrosia, you know, by day, and then puts him into fire by night. So it's very symbolic. We have the same in the Homeric hymn to Demeter. So it looks like this is either, you know, something that, you know, was a common motive, but something, or something that these poets liked. And Peleus comes and he interrupts her. So obviously, you know, the ritual goes unfinished. But you could say that something of it remains in Achilles. There's always this idea that something remains after this kind of transformation. And Thetis departs from the home of Peleus. She's mortally offended and she never returns. So basically, here is only the start of the story as we know from the Iliad. So basically, she has such a long and complicated biography before her, and there is so much that happened to her. And what we see in the Iliad are only echoes of the stories that happened before, which were described either by the later sources or the sources that we don't have or survive only in the fragments. But what we have suggests that she had this prophecy about her. She kept company with the greatest gods of Olympus. She raised them. She made them who they are. But she always is very quiet about her power. And she never says what is it about her that makes her so powerful. And I think this is what makes her so great.
Yes, and I feel like there are so many reasons why she is so fascinating. And also, I don't even think you got to when she stops the coup. I forget what source that comes in.
Oh, yeah.
But she also saves Zeus. It is in the Iliad. Okay. Yeah. She also fully saves Zeus from a coup. Like, she's just so much.
And, you know, basically, you know, let's look at this coup in a bit more detail. So basically, you have Zeus who is bound. And who binds Zeus here? We've got Athena. We have Poseidon and Hera. And some scholars also say that Apollo also took part, because, you know, obviously, you know, they wanted to say all the gods, basically. So they just gave you a selection, but basically it was supposed to mean that all the gods bound Zeus. And Thetis comes and she summons Briareus and he unbinds Zeus. But basically, for the moment that Briareus was, so to say, in transit, she was able to hold her own at least against three Olympians. Three Olympians, I kid you not. Just think about this.
Yeah.
And here again, we have this motive of binding and unbinding, and she is just able to do so effortlessly So just, she's just a character.
Yeah. I feel like she's kind of like hoarding favors from these important gods too. Yeah. Like Hephaestus, Dionysus, Zeus. Like she just is like, if I, you know, save all of these men in all of these different ways, like they're gonna owe me and I'm gonna have that in my back pocket whenever I need it. And like obviously, like
when... here you have an interesting question.
Yeah.
What happens if they were to refuse the favors owed?
Yeah.
Like for instance, what kind of leverage does she have still? And I think that this prophecy that was about her, it was never said that it only works once.
Right.
Like, because technically, yeah, like at any point, and you know, we have this wonderful piece of Melanippides, who is just a fragmentary poet, 5th century, who says that Thetis was already pregnant by Zeus when he heard the story of Themis. Which is like, I was just, my mind was blown. We think, okay, because it makes a lot of sense. Because if Zeus wants to impregnate somebody, it's going to happen.
Yeah.
Like, he's not going to wait.
No.
So it just made such a lot of sense that there was this missing child. What happened to it?
Yeah.
What happened to the son of Zeus and Thetis? And it just, we have this small mention, no, you know, no other surviving source speaks about this missing child, but it is there. And it makes a lot of sense in the logic of the Greek myth.
Yeah. When I had David on the show, he mentioned the book on Thetis and I immediately was like, oh, I need it. And then I forgot about it. And now you've just reminded me how interesting she is. But like, yeah, I just feel like it's endless. Like, there's just so much there. I didn't know about that fragment. That's really interesting. I want to just know all the fragments. Like, I don't know how people find everything. Like, I feel like I'm constantly learning where to find more sources, even if they're fragmentary. And then brand new ones get mentioned to me. And I'm just like, it's endless in the best and most frustrating way.
It is, really, it is. Basically, you know, the problem is that, you know, the sources are very, you know, dispersed.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some collections right now. So, for instance, the Lab series has some collections of ancient Greek fragments.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, you know, this is only a collection. So by nature, it's a selection. And you can always go to the Scholia and to ancient commentaries on the Iliad and Hesiod and find more and more and more. So there are heaps upon heaps of these sources. And you never know what's going to fit your story point or angle. So basically, you have to keep looking, and it's a bit like sailing on choppy waters. So you never know which way to go and where you're going to find the island or not. You just have to go there and try to find your way.
Yeah. Well, even when you brought up the bit about her testing all her, you know, potions and things on past children, I immediately remembered, like, I did an episode on her. I don't even remember when. The problem is I also write these weekly, and so, like, I'm just constantly researching all the stuff and learning all these new things. And then they like get filed away in the back of my mind and I forget about them until somebody brings it up. Because you said, I was like, oh, right. I remember reading all about that. Like I put it into the episode because it was just wild. It's like this little random kind of one-off statement where it's like, oh, yeah. And there was the time that she like experimented on a bunch of babies. You're like, oh. Like,
and she killed six of them,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it reminds me, you know, going back to the family of Helios, like there's another, and it might also, I just know that Diodorus Siculus has a ton about Medea, so it might be him again, but like there's this moment, this one source where he's like, yeah, Aetes was evil because he was like having Medea, or he was doing it himself, like testing poisons on people, or no, it was Hecate. It's when Hecate is her mother, she gets this kind of like much more like evil personality than she has in earlier sources. And it's that like she's just testing poisons on people, whoever stops by Colchis. And it's just, it's so fun. Like I feel like sometimes the later sources got a little bit darker in a way that I love. They're just like willing to talk about violence a lot more.
Yeah, and if you take Hellenistic sources, it often is that they try to find a version that isn't as well known. So by nature, it would you know, steer towards the darker interpretations of mythology.
Yeah.
And what, you know, for Medea, I think that there might be an explanation why her family is so twisted and unusual. Because, well, I've been looking at them for quite a long time and I've noticed that they're all very unlucky in love. Like, you know, and they have all these weird sexual desires. I mean, Pasiphae coupled with a bull. Who does that? And Medea, you know, is also unlucky in love. And you can also say the same for Circe in the Metamorphoses. You can read all about this sordid story, like she fell in love, but it was not to be.
Yeah.
So basically, you can say that. And, you know, in the very late sources, for instance, in the library of Apollodorus, you can read that there is a story here that, you know, Aphrodite and the family of Helios are never friends. And it's a very short mention, and I tried to look at that, but then I realized, obviously, Helios told on Aphrodite and Ares.
Right.
He did that, and it's explained that, and because of that, Aphrodite was ever hateful to Helios and his children, generation after generation, and she would curse them, and she would make them suffer in love, because this is the only way that she could get them.
Yeah.
And this is the only case, I think, where you have a goddess cursing the family of another god.
Yeah.
Because you don't get that. I mean, you do get spats and they might dislike each other, but for it to be, you know, so long lasting and just to pass generation after generation, this is something which is very unusual. And I think it's connected to this weird liminal space they occupy. Like, they are not quite divine, but they are not human.
Yeah.
And this is also this experiment place when you can see what would happen if the gods were cursed.
Nerds, thank you as always. Gods, this was an incredible conversation, and you have only heard the first half of it. Just you wait. Oh my god, it's just mind-blowing. Also, I realize I mentioned the Thetis book many times, but we didn't actually say the name. So if you are interested in that, it is called The Staying Power of Thetis. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is written and produced by me, Liv Albert. Michaela Smith is the Hermes to my Olympians, my assistant producer. Laura Smith is now the production assistant and audio engineer. Welcome, Laura! The podcast is part of the iHeart Podcast Network. Listen on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Help me continue bringing you the world of Greek mythology and the ancient Mediterranean by becoming a patron, where you will get bonus episodes and more. Visit patreon.com/mythsbaby or click the link in this episode's description. I am Liv. And oh my gods, I love this shit.
We went from normal life, healthy child, to acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
What's up, y'all? Janice Torres here.
And I'm Austin Hankwitz.
We're the hosts of Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories, a podcast presented by iHeartRadio's Ruby Studios and Intuit QuickBooks. Join us as we speak with small business owners about the tools they use to turn their ideas into success.
From finding that initial spark of entrepreneurship to organizing payments and invoices, we've got you covered. So follow and listen to Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah, and some waves so we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that.
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in.
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it.
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby.
Wait, did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.